given what was already being done, it was a perverse twisting of reality. That fall, the Mujahideen in the Pakistani training camps were not only receiving a flood of lethal weapons, they were also being trained to wage a war of urban terror with instruction in car bombings, bicycle bombings, camel bombings, and assassination. Just how vicious a campaign the CIA was sponsoring is suggested by the Pakistan Brigadier Muhammad Yusuf, who directed the training with and distribution of CIA weapons at that time. In a matter-of-fact passage in his memoirs, he describes the range of assassination tactics and targets he was preparing the Mujahideen to take on in Kabul. They ranged from your everyday knife between the shoulder blades of a Soviet soldier shopping in the bazaar to the placing of a briefcase bomb in a senior official's office. Educational institutions were considered fair game, he explains, since they were staffed by communists indoctrinating their students with Marxist dogma. What made Canestraro's whispering campaign charging cowardice and timidity in the Afghan arena so perverse was that it came at a time when Avrakatos was responsible for over $500 million worth of weapons and training going into the funding of an exceedingly dirty war. Yet somehow AEVA, backed by conservative senators who followed his lead, insisted that the CIA was guilty of cowardice. According to Avrakatos, Casey came to loathe Canestraro, calling him that fucking Dago. Claire George was also up in arms, according to Gust, and came to him to explain how Canestraro could be neutralized. This was the kind of special assignment that had won Gust his old agency nickname, Dr. Dirty, and he accepted it with relish. Gust knew that the politically ambitious Canestraro would want to try to recruit the most powerful congressman on Afghanistan as an ally, so he arranged to have Vince meet him in Wilson's office. "I wanted to put him totally out of place," remembers Avrakatos. "He had no business doing what he was doing, and I figured that if he and the NSC were going to slap me around, I wanted to show him he'd have to deal with Charlie." Canestraro, who later appeared regularly as an intelligence expert on ABC News and such TV shows as 60 Minutes, remembers feeling quite out of place that day, not being able to get a word in edgewise and amazed at the intense camaraderie he and Charlie shared. "They loved each other," Gust says. "I sat back and watched them talking about big tits and guns." Gust's next move was pure Greek melodrama. He arrived at the airport for a trip with Vince to Pakistan dressed all in black. Before boarding the plane, he says he cornered Canestraro and read him his rights. "You know you went to Central America and gave the agency heartburn, and you're not going to get away with it on this one." But it was an incident on the flight from Pakistan that gave Canestraro a real look at the side of Avrakatos no one would want to have to deal with. They were traveling on diplomatic passports, and Gust managed to upgrade them to first class, where they met the interior minister from one of the Gulf states. The Arab, who was drinking heavily, ended up insulting Gust. Gust belted him and followed this up by pulling out his knife and loudly threatening to cut the man's balls off. Canestraro watched with horror as Gust proceeded to hurl insults at the bug-eyed minister, accusing him of sinning in the eyes of Allah by drinking. Canestraro remembers being quite unnerved by this excessive aggression. "I was afraid to be sitting next to him. I thought the man was going to come back at us with a knife. Gust is not a gentle person." After describing this incident, the soft-spoken Canestraro added that there was another moment in Pakistan that was every bit as bad. He almost throttled the head of the motor pool at the embassy because the man didn't give him the car he wanted. Gust was making a point with Vince. He made only one direct threat at the very beginning of the trip. Afterward, he was very courteous with his traveling companion, only demonstrating in his inimitable way how he dealt with minor aggravations. No doubt Canestraro must have wondered what Avrakatos might be prepared to do if he determined someone was a true enemy. This was Dr. Dirty operating in his prime. But as far as Avrakatos is concerned, the crowning blow came at dinner in Peshawar, when Gust followed the explicit prescription of his division chief, Bert Dunn, to make sure to take him to a fucking restaurant where you can get him sick. Over the years, Avrakatos had built up a stomach immune to foreign microbes. He says, "I even ate everything in Bujumbura, Burundi, where every white man got sick. I have a cast-iron stomach." He took Vince to a native restaurant in Peshawar, full of character, singing the praises of the food, calling it very clean. Gus ate everything with relish, knowing full well that the next day Vince Canestraro would be out of the picture. Bert was absolutely delighted, Avrakatos recalls. Bert just loved that Vince was sick for 2 days and couldn't do shit. He was like a little country boy who just shot his first squirrel when I told him about it. By the time the two returned, Gus felt he needed to say nothing more. He had made his point, and he says that Canestraro's report evaluating the CIA program had nothing damaging in it. It started off by saying the agency had a well-run program, and it was so wishy-washy that it was meaningless. Chicken-shit criticism about procurement and storage of perishables. Nothing about important stuff. Although most of this test of wills had been about personality conflicts, the agency leadership had felt that a principle had been at stake. Never before had any outside agency attempted to investigate and critique the operations side of the CIA's work, and Gust's effort to back down Canestraro was received as an important victory to prevent a dangerous precedent from being established. But that was just round one, and Avrakatos knew that Canestraro would be back. Vince could be greatly underestimated by his opponents, including Casey. He has certain qualities that I admire, revenge being one of them. Avrakatos found himself in the midst of this unprecedented covert escalation, repeatedly threatened by bizarre challenges from totally unexpected quarters. It was also strange that he actually came to see himself as a voice of reason, facing down perfectly deranged figures who happened to have the potential to do great damage. The arch-conservative senators, who had always been so blindly supportive of the agency in the past, now became the kind of friends who make it unnecessary to have enemies. In the name of trying to help, they seemed quite prepared to bring the whole program down. Ironically, the only real impact of all these hard-right assaults may have been to give the program the cover it absolutely needed. The scope and the disquieting details of the Muslim Jihad that the CIA was then sponsoring surely warranted Congress's attention. The agency was not just flooding Afghanistan with weapons of every nature. It was now unapologetically moving to equip and train cadres of high-tech holy warriors in the art of waging a war of urban terror against a modern superpower. But reporters did not choose to examine these themes in any depth, and before any congressional skeptics could investigate or seriously question whether the program might be growing too large, Humphrey, Ieva, and Free the Eagle shouted to anyone who would listen, and many who didn't want to, that the CIA was denying the Afghans the weapons the president wanted them to have. Meanwhile, Democratic liberals and reporters who might ordinarily have questioned the wisdom of these programs simply couldn't figure out how to overcome the impression left by right-wing critics that the CIA's crime in this case was not doing too much but too little, that McMahon and the agency were subverting the president's clear mandate. While the CIA threw itself into arming, training, and funding the largest Muslim jihad in modern history, the only ones to register their outrage and demand change were those who seemed to believe that the CIA's support was so meaningless as to constitute a betrayal of the Afghans.